Everyone, to today's internet seminar. My name is Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division based in Washington, D.C., where I'll be helping to moderate our broadcast today. We will be joined by a number of presenters from EPA, including Joe Bruss. Gail Cooper is going to make some welcoming statements, and then Kathleen Curry is also going to be joining us later on. Before we begin the technical portion of our broadcast, though, I'm going to cover a few housekeeping items or reminders on how our session will operate today so that we can have hopefully a very efficient and useful expenditure of your time today. The first thing I want to let everybody know, I'm on a housekeeping slide. If you've printed off a hard copy, I'm on slide number 2. The housekeeping slide basically gives you some just general summary of how our session will run. The entire broadcast is actually going to be offered online through a meeting tool called Adobe Connect. So if you haven't officially registered for the session, I would encourage you to go back to the CLUIN website. That's at www.cluin.org and actually sign up for the session. You'll find links to our training calendar or live webinars. And you can sign up and join in to the live broadcast. Our presenters are actually going to go through the materials in real time. You can actually sit back and watch as I move through the materials at our speakers' verbal cues. If you have only printed out a copy, you can still follow along on the phone lines, but we'd encourage you to try to join us online through Adobe Connect for a more interactive experience. By default, audio is going to be available for everyone through the online meeting interface, so you can all listen to this through your computer or mobile device. If you're having any problems with the online audio, I'd ask you to first check your local volume settings. Sometimes it's just a matter of turning up the volume knob on your speaker or going into your sound control panel and actually increasing your speaker output. Some participants have also found wearing a pair of headphones helps. If you have any problems with that online audio, you can't get it loud enough, we do have toll-free call-in information, and we'll be happy to share it with anybody who needs it. Simply type a message into the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen, and we'll be happy to share the call-in information with anyone who needs it. I have globally muted the telephone lines, and I'd ask that everybody remain on that global mute to help cut down on background noises and disruptions. We will be taking breaks for Q&A with our presenters once they've gone through the full presentation, but while they're giving their talks, you are encouraged to use the Q&A window to actually type up your comments or questions throughout the session so we can build up a healthy queue and get through as many questions as we can in the time allotted. So I'm going to draw your attention to the lower right corner of your screen. You should see a Q&A window which has a welcome message in there for me, Jean Balance. You can actually type your comments or question at the very bottom of that window. There's a thin white line. You can type them up and click the little cartoon bubble to the right, and that will privately submit your questions or comments to me, and we'll queue them up until we take our Q&A break. And at that point, I'll read them out loud so our presenters can answer them. Again, no need to wait. You can start asking them now. And in fact, if you want to test the feature out, I'd be happy to answer any test questions or status updates. If you want to let me know if everything sounds loud and clear, feel free to test that out in the Q&A window. Our entire session is being recorded and will be archived. You will automatically receive an email from me as soon as that archive is available to download or replay. So if you think this is helpful or want to refer a colleague to it, you're very welcome to forward that email on or pass them over to the CLUIN website. If you like what we're doing here, this is exactly the type of free sessions that we offer through the Cleanup Information Network. We offer them nearly every day. And I'd encourage you to take a moment to browse through our archive, which is available on the CLUIN website, where we have nearly 400 recorded sessions available. I'm on a little quick screenshot of our seminar interface. Again, you're going to see most of your screen is occupied by a large window with the slides, and I'll be moving through the materials for you, as Joe indicates, for me to move through. If you're having problems viewing it, there's a full screen button that appears in the upper right corner. You guys can click that full screen button, and that'll actually expand the slides on your end, but it won't disrupt anybody else's view. If you want to go back to the normal view, simply press the full screen button again, and it'll shrink it back down to the normal size. You see our CLUIN logo in the upper right corner. Below that, you'll see a listing of related websites. Specifically, I'll draw your attention to the Fiscal 13 Grants Guidelines website. You can actually click on any one of those URLs, press the Browse To button, and it'll open it up locally on your own computer. And then, of course, that very important Q&A window in the lower right corner. You can type your comments or questions here, press the little cartoon bubble, and it'll privately submit them to me in our online queue so that we can help address them. If anybody needs the call-in numbers, things are going too fast, too slow, you have questions, you want copies of the slides, just start submitting them in the Q&A and we'll be happy to work with them. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So I've gone on to slide number 4, and Joe, this is the start of your materials. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to our speaker for today's session. And again, this is Joseph Bruss with the EPA's Brownfields Program as part of today's fiscal year 13 EPA Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grant application, specifically looking at the guidelines and requests for proposals in an overview presentation. So Joe Bruss, feel free to take it away.
Thanks, Jean. Before we get started on the PowerPoint presentation for today, I would first like to introduce Gail Cooper, Deputy Director for the Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization, to provide some welcoming remarks. Gail?
Thank you, Joe. Good afternoon, everyone. I want to welcome all of you to the annual CLUIN Job Training Seminar. So as was stated this afternoon, we'll provide an overview of the Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grant Proposal Guidelines. And we're very excited about this year's competition, and I'd like to welcome both our new applicants and those who may be reapplying. Under this year's competition, we will again be providing communities with the flexibility to design their own training curricula in order to meet the local labor markets in their communities. So through the development of partnerships with other EPA offices, including our Office of Superfund, the Underground Storage Tank Office, Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention, Resource Conservation and Recovery, our Wastewater Management Office, and our Emergency Management Office, due to these partnerships, we've expanded the job training program, and this will allow applicants and those awarded with grants to deliver a wider selection of environmental training, and we're very excited about that. There are two areas in which we'll be giving a preference through the solicitation process this year, and the first is to applicants proposing to serve communities that have experienced recent manufacturing plant closures. And the second, or other significant economic disruptions. And the second preference is to those applicants that choose to provide a variety of the environmental training that I just talked about. So at first glance, our proposal guidelines might seem a bit overwhelming, especially to new applicants, but I would encourage you to please read the guidelines carefully and don't be intimidated. Ask questions. Please refer to our website and the many resources available on our website. Please contact your EPA Regional Job Training Coordinator. Those are listed in Section 7 of the proposed guidelines, and they will be able to help you with any questions you might have. We will have time for questions and answers at the end of the presentation today, and so I want to thank you very much for participating on today's call, and I wish all of you much success. Thank you.
Thanks, Gail. So we have a lot of slides to get through today, so I'm going to try to move quickly. I might skip a few areas, but you have a copy of today's presentation. You can always refer to it later. For today's presentation, I'm first going to give a brief history of the Brownfields Job Training Program, and then provide an overview explaining why we changed the title of the program to the Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grant Program, and then provide an overview of the application process, the threshold criteria, that's the eligibility criteria, then our ranking evaluation criteria, discuss the attachments, and provide some tips, next steps, additional resources, and then open it up for questions and answers. I will hand it over to Kathleen Curry from Region 4, and she will begin to discuss the evaluation criteria. So starting on page 4, this is a picture of one of our prior Brownfields Job Training Grant recipients, Milwaukee Community Service Corps. On page 5, first, a brief history of the program. What's the objective of the program? The first seeds of the Brownfields Job Training Program and of the Brownfields Program itself emerged in the early 90s, reflecting EPA's growing concern for environmental equity, later known as environmental justice issues. Many of you are aware that the Brownfields Program at EPA offers several different grant opportunities, not just the job training, but we also provide grants for assessment, cleanup, and revolving loan fund grants, as well as Brownfields area-wide among others. Among the lessons learned from the very first EPA Brownfields pilot grants was the realization that the communities surrounding these sites were not benefiting from the job opportunities created by their assessment and cleanup. So the EPA realized that these Brownfields-related jobs were being filled by environmental professionals from other cities due to a lack of environmental training among local workforces. Next slide. While the EPA had no resources allocated for job training during the initial years of the Brownfields program, the agency had already collaborated with the Hazardous Materials Training Research Institute to offer environmental education and training program assistance to community colleges located near Superfund and other hazardous waste sites. With the goal of adding a job training component to the Brownfields program, EPA tapped the expertise of a number of federal entities with established job training programs, including the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, who continues to remain a partner today. Next slide. So in January 1995, EPA announced the first Brownfields pilot. And in 1996, the EPA signed a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Labor. In 98, we worked with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, and they established what was called the Brownfields Minority Worker Training Program, which some of you might be aware of. I'm not going to go through all these specific dates, but I did want to provide an overview of the history of the program. On the next slide, in January 2002, that's when we received statutory authority to fund job training grants. And it was later known as the Brownfields Law, also referred to as the Small Business Liability Relief and Brownfields Revitalization Act. Specifically, under the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, or CERCLA as we call it, we have the language specifically authorizing job training grants. It authorizes EPA to provide grants for training to facilitate site assessment, remediation of brownfield sites, or site preparation. To date, we funded 206 job training grants totaling over $45 million through both the former Brownfields Job Training Program and the newly expanded Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grant Program. It's a long title, but we wanted to really point out that it's no longer just about brownfields. This is a multi-appropriation, multi-statutory program, one of the few at EPA. So we've created these partnerships across the agency, again, to provide communities flexibility to deliver a multitude of environmental training, not just in brownfields. As of November 2012, approximately 11,100 individuals completed training, and of those, 7,900 obtained employment in the environmental field, with an average starting hourly wage of $14.12. This equates to a cumulative placement rate of approximately 71% that we're really happy with. This is an excellent placement rate for a federal training program, and this data includes training and placement data since the program was first started in 1998. Next slide. As Gail pointed out, we are now working closely and collaborating with other programs across the agency. Those programs include the Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. That's the solid waste program that deals with recycling and other solid waste issues. We also have partnerships with the Superfund program, the Office of Underground Storage Tanks, the Center for Program Analysis. The Center for Program Analysis looks at preparing formerly contaminated sites for renewable energies. We also have partnerships with the Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention. We've always stressed the importance of environmental health and safety through this program. The Office of Wastewater Management, that supports training in wastewater treatment facility operator training, as well as stormwater management, low-impact development, and also the Office of Emergency Management. Next slide. So what is really the objective of the Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grant Program? It's designed to recruit, train, and place unemployed and severely underemployed residents from communities impacted by the presence of a variety of waste facilities, blighted properties, and contaminated sites for environmental jobs that may otherwise be filled from outside the affected community by contractors selected to clean up these sites. The goal was to also develop a job training program through a cooperative agreement that offers an opportunity for expanded training in other environmental media, as I mentioned. This program is purposed to further environmental justice by ensuring that residents, including low-income, minority, and tribal communities, living communities historically affected by economic disinvestment, health disparities, environmental contamination, have an opportunity to reap the benefits of revitalization and environmental cleanup. This program also supports the Community Engagement Initiative, which is an initiative out of the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. Next slide. So through the expanded job training program, graduates develop wider skill sets that improve their ability to secure full-time sustainable employment in various aspects of hazardous and solid waste management and within the larger environmental field, including water quality improvement and chemical safety. Through the years, we realized that oftentimes graduates that went to work at brownfield sites, many of those jobs were sometimes short-term or contractual in nature. So we really always supported the idea of providing interdisciplinary training, providing graduates with a multitude of differing certifications. So once one project they went to work on was completed, they had other skills that would equip them to continue sustainable employment. We don't want to train graduates to work at a site for 1 month and then they become unemployed. In addition to the focus of the program stated above, under this year's FY13 competition, as Gail mentioned, applicants from communities affected by recent manufacturing plant closures, 2007 or later, or experiencing other significant economic disruptions are anticipated to receive some funding preference. Communities now have more flexibility to provide different types of environmental training that reflect local labor market assessments and employers' hiring needs. Next slide. Program requirements. Proposed training programs must target unemployed and underemployed individuals. This grant program is not designed to really provide training to individuals that have advanced education or have advanced education or, you know, really haven't been unemployed for that long. This program is really designed to benefit local residents in waste-impacted communities, those who are severely underemployed, those making minimum wage, you know, really the most disadvantaged residents in the communities that we serve. We do state, however, that grant funds can be used provide training to dislocated workers, for example. We know that times are tough right now, and we want to be flexible, but we really want to emphasize that this grant program is to serve mostly unemployed individuals. Applicants will be evaluated on the extent to which they have partnered and secured hiring commitments with local contractors and other stakeholders for EPA-funded projects for brownfield, Superfund sites, underground storage tanks, landfills, oil spill sites, wastewater treatment facilities, or EPA-funded state and tribal corrective actions or closures at solid or hazardous waste facilities are taking place. Applicants should establish procedures to ensure that graduates will be employed in environmental work that involves preventing, assessing, managing, and cleaning up contaminated sites in the respective communities. Proposed training should be directly linked to ongoing environmental work taking place in the community. Next slide. Applicants may choose, in addition to brownfield hazardous waste training, to deliver a variety of environmental training listed below in items 1-6. Please note the guidelines changed this year. Last year, we required all applicants to deliver a variety of environmental skills. This year, applicants have the choice to deliver those or not to deliver those different types of training, but they're no longer required. The only required training listed in the threshold eligibility criteria is the HAZWOPR training, which must be provided to all graduates. Training may include all of the items in 1 through 6, none of them, or multiple items. Please note that applicants have the option to deliver all of the training listed, either at awareness level or advanced levels. Applicants must indicate the type of training and at what level the training will be delivered in the transmittal cover letter. Applicants also have the option to deliver only brownfield hazardous waste training. As noted in the guidelines, EPA selection official, when making funding decisions, may take into consideration and give preference to applicants who choose to deliver multiple types of training listed in items 1 through 6. Next slide. So these different types of training, these are items 1 through 6. The training includes leaking underground storage tank site assessment and corrective action with a focus on training in the remediation of high priority leaking underground storage tanks, also referred to as LUS sites. The second type of training is solid waste management or cleanup training. And we go into more detail about what this training could include. It could include construction and demolition debris recycling, electronics recycling, capping of landfills, the list goes on. The third type of training is Superfund site cleanup training, and this includes innovative and alternative treatment technologies, also known as green remediation technologies. The fourth type is wastewater treatment training. Doesn't necessarily have to be training in wastewater treatment facility operator training, but it could also include training such as stormwater management or low impact development. The fifth type is emergency response training, and the sixth is enhanced environmental health and safety training. Next slide. So those are the six main different types of training, as well as the brownfield hazardous waste training. However, we want to be flexible in the different types of training that applicants can choose to provide. So in addition to those different types of training, we also have many other types of training. And some of the examples I'm going to list now. So additional eligible uses of grant funds. Applicants must indicate what other training they propose to deliver in their course outline, as referenced in Section 5B2. Other examples of eligible uses of grant funds and training include personnel costs for instructors to conduct training, fringe benefits or personnel costs, costs for screening and placement of individuals into the program, training materials, work gear, development and refinement of existing curricula, implementing job development outreach activities directed towards engaging prospective employers to be involved in the job training program, and ultimately to hire graduates. Next slide. Training and assessment inventory analysis and remediation of sites or facilities at which hazardous substances, pollutants, contaminants, and petroleum are located. Training in lead abatement, RRP, asbestos abatement, mold remediation, sites contaminated by the manufacturing of illegal drugs or meth labs, abandoned gas stations, also training in the remediation of mine-scarred land. Please note, this year we are now allowing applicants to provide training in technologies that use alternative energy, solar, wind, or geothermal, or alternative fuels such as biofuels, including preparing sites for renewable energy installation. Last year it was not eligible, but this year it is eligible again. Next slide. Other types of training include confined space entry, first aid, CPR, bloodborne pathogens, chemistry, toxicology, radiation safety, cleanup of uranium mine tailings and other mine-scarred land, hazmat, commercial driver's license, forklift, heavy machinery operations, freon removal, weatherization, BPI, energy efficiency, the list goes on. Next slide. again, I don't think I need to read through all of the different types of training, but we really try to be as detailed as possible about all the many different types of training. Ultimately, I think it's important to note that just because the training sounds nice or maybe because it sounds innovative, we ultimately want to see that that training matches the hiring needs of employers in the community. Next slide. Again, here's some additional types of training. LEAD, CAD, blueprint reading, etc. Applicants must indicate what other training they propose to deliver in their course outline, as I mentioned. Next slide. So what are some of the different jobs that graduates of this program go on to? Some of these include environmental technician, recycling center operator, emergency response technician, GIS technician, health and safety, underground storage tank removal specialist, hazardous materials transporter, or a wastewater treatment facility operator. Next slide. Other eligible costs. Costs related to health exams, drug testing, or licensing fees are eligible uses of funds. Any funding used to pay for such fees must be applied before training is completed and expended before the close of the grant. Costs used to cover rental fees associated with training facilities or minor alteration of existing facilities. Construction costs are not eligible. Costs associated with eligible participant support expenses, including transportation for trainees for site visits during training or transport to and from class, is eligible. Please note, however, that we do not allow grant funds to be used for general stipends for students. Grant funds cannot be used either to provide scholarships for trainees. Next slide. Other ineligible use of grant funds, training in general construction skills and trades. I know that many of you already have programs where you're delivering training in the trades and construction. These grant funds, however, cannot be used for that. Grant funds also cannot be used to conduct assessments or cleanups. A big ineligible use of funds that I know many applicants don't necessarily like, but these grant funds cannot be used for life skills training. In the early years of the program, we realized that the Department of Labor was providing millions of dollars to support life skills training across the country. So we've always really looked for applicants that have partnerships or who are already able to deliver this critical training. Life skills training, especially given the populations that we're serving, is critical. However, these grant funds are used really to focus on environmental training. Life skills training, so GED costs, website development, vehicle or medical insurance, child care or daycare costs, those costs are ineligible. I already mentioned that stipends for students, we're now on slide 23, is an ineligible use of funds. Providing food or light refreshments to employees, instructors, and trainees, except at graduation ceremonies. Costs that also are unallowable, lobbying, fundraising, etc. Another important point to make about these grant funds is that under our statutory authority, we do not have the authority to use the grant funds for administrative costs. I know that many academic institutions that are planning on applying, this may be a turnoff for you, but unfortunately these grant funds cannot be used to pay overhead or indirect administrative costs. Please read the appendix carefully on what is constituted or what an administrative cost is exactly. Page 24, here are some additional ineligible uses of grant funds. Again, I don't need to go through all of these, but you can refer to these. On page 25, this provides an overview of the EPA strategic plan linkage. You will be asked under the evaluation criteria, which Kathleen is going to talk about, to discuss outputs and outcomes for your project. Next slide. Page 26. What are some of the statistics? Historically, EPA has set a high standard for successful job training grant applications. In past years, an average of 1 out of every 4 applications was funded per solicitation. However, with the new focus on green jobs and the growing interest in this field, in FY11, we received a record number of applications, and only 1 out of every 12 applicants was funded. From year to year, 90% of previously unfunded applicants who reapplied are successful and consequently were funded after reapplying. So the statistics are pretty good. I anticipate that this year we might receive about 85 proposals, and we anticipate funding approximately 11 or 12 grant awards. But like I said, don't be intimidated. We have a lot of resources for you to build a strong proposal. If you're not successful this year, come in again next year, get a debriefing from your regional job training coordinator, and keep trying. FY13's total estimated funding is $2.4 million, so that equates roughly to 12 grant awards. Next slide. So getting started, to begin the application process, you can go to www.epa.gov and look at the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response Grants and Funding webpage. You can also access the Request for Proposals, or the Proposal Guidelines, as we call them, on the Brownfields website. You can also access the Request for Proposals on grants.gov. Next slide. Applicants may submit their proposals either in hard copy paper or electronically through grants.gov. If you submit in paper, we ask that you submit 2 copies of your proposal. 1 copy goes to the regional job training coordinator listed in Section 7 of the guidelines, and 1 copy of the proposal goes to Environmental Management Support, EPA's contractor. Attention to Keith Arnold. Let me warn you, if you plan on submitting through grants.gov, there is a registration process. Do it early. Do not wait until the last minute, because sometimes there are issues with grants.gov. Next slide. Proposals are due April 9th. It's a shortened time frame this year, but April 9th is the deadline. Proposals may be sent through the U.S. Postal Service, a commercial delivery service, or through grants.gov. Only 1 method should be used. Proposals sent through the USPS or via commercial delivery service must be postmarked by April 9th. Proposals sent through grants.gov, you can submit all the way up until 11:59 p.m. Next slide. Here's another picture of one of our past job training grant recipients. This is Oregon Tradeswomen. I think our only women's focused training program. Next slide, slide 31. These are the threshold criteria. Threshold criteria are evaluated on a pass or fail basis. Threshold criteria include applicant eligibility, demonstration that the proposed project does not duplicate other federally funded environmental job training programs. Number 3, the required HAZWOPR training. Number 4, the funding amount. Don't request over $200,000. And the project periods are 3 years. They used to be 2 years in the past, but they are 3 years. Applicants who received an EPA Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grant last year in fiscal year 2012 are not eligible to apply in FY13 unless proposing to serve a different city. EPA will notify applicants not meeting the threshold criteria within 15 calendar days of the failed determination. Applications failing any one of the threshold criteria will not be given further consideration, and their proposals will not advance to the ranking evaluation process. Next slide. So who are eligible applicants? Eligible applicants include nonprofit organizations with 501c3 or other IRS nonprofit designation, municipalities, quasi-governmental organizations, governmental entities, regional councils, redevelopment agencies, states, tribes other than Alaska, because our statute does not allow Alaskan tribes to apply, workforce investment boards, and colleges and universities are also eligible. Nonprofit entities or organizations are eligible for funding. Proof of current nonprofit designation and status is required as an attachment, and that proof or documentation will not count towards the page limitation. Number two, demonstration that proposed project does not duplicate other federally funded environmental job training programs. Applicants must demonstrate that the proposed training project does not duplicate other federally funded programs for environmental job training in the target community. For example, some of these other programs include the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, Hazardous Waste Management Training Program, the Department of Labor, or the Department of Energy. Proposed training does not duplicate another nonprofit organization's or EPA-funded environmental technician training curriculum in the same geographical area that you're proposing to target. We do provide a list of all the grants that we funded and the communities being served on our website. Please look at that. Next slide. Federal agencies maintain lists of these grant programs at the following sites. And here you'll see all the different websites, and you can check to ensure that your proposed program does not duplicate other federally funded programs. Next slide. If you are listed on any of these websites as a recipient, you must demonstrate how services under the proposed project will complement but not duplicate the existing federal environmental job training activities in the target community. Perhaps you are proposing to serve a different target audience, a different age group. Maybe you are proposing to deliver other types of certifications that another grant is not. If you are not listed on the above websites but are the recipient of other federally funded environmental or green job training programs serving your area or community, you must similarly demonstrate how services under this proposed project will complement but not duplicate the existing federal activities. These other programs may include HUD, HHS, and other federal agencies. The EPA will also conduct internal screening to ensure demonstration and non-duplication, and we will coordinate duplication screening with federal partners, such as the Department of Labor and NIEHS. Next slide. The third threshold criterion, the required HAZWOPR training, as I already mentioned. Your proposal must demonstrate that OSHA 29 CFR 1910.120 40-hour HAZWOPR training will be incorporated into the proposed curriculum. The course must be required of all trainees participating in the proposed program. The reason we do this, you might ask, is we really want to encourage environmental health and safety training for all individuals entering the program. Next slide. Application packages must substantially conform to the outline and content detailed in Section 4C. Applications must include the transmittal letter or the cover letter, which is a maximum of 3 pages in single space. Pages in excess of the page limitations for the transmittal letter, the narrative proposal, which is 15 pages, and the attachments, which is 15 pages, will not be reviewed. All application materials must be submitted in English, including support letters. Do not include binders, spiral binding, or color printing. Photos and graphics are also not going to be considered. The transmittal letter and narrative proposal must be typed on letter-sized paper with a font size no smaller than 12. Next slide. We're now on slide 38. This is the ranking criteria. Kathleen, are you on the line?
And Kathleen, remember, if you've muted your telephone line, you'll need to unmute so you can speak up and let us know you're there. I did get confirmation from another attendee that she was with us. Oh, yes, is that Kathleen?
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you, Kathleen.
Okay, great. I'm sorry. I had issues with Adobe Connect, so it was rough. Still not in. Okay, ranking criteria overview. Hello, everyone, and thanks for calling in. Basically, the applicants must directly and explicitly address all criteria as part of their narrative proposal. What we mean by this is your response must be on point. It cannot be vague. It cannot be incomplete. And it must directly respond to the query being posed to you. Each application will be evaluated and scored under a point system. Maximum amount of points for this proposal is 100 points. Each application will be evaluated according to 5 evaluation criteria. Each of the 5 criteria is comprised of sub-factors that vary in scoring value. Slide 39. The criterion or criteria as listed is first, community need worth maximum points 20, training program description with anticipated outcomes and outputs, maximum points 23, programmatic capabilities 24, community and employer partnerships 25, budget and leveraging resources 8. Again, maximum points that can be earned are 100. Next slide. Community need, overall 20 points. The first sub-factor, community description, is worth 10 points. And the reason why I'm going through and reading what is already in the guidelines is so that if there are any questions that need, that you would like clarified, any other sub-factors clarified, this is the time. You are to provide a detailed description of your community. You must paint a picture of your community with your words. We should be able to visualize the blight that has been caused by the presence of brownfields in your area. And that's the most important thing. You have got to link whatever woes, economic, social, health, back to the presence of brownfields. It's not just enough to tell us what the need is, but you have to also show where it was the presence of the brownfields that directly impacted your community. Use the sample table that's provided for you to give us the demographic information about your community. Please include the population, unemployment rate, poverty rate, percent of minorities in your area, per capita income, and any other relevant statistics. And please, as the sample table shows you, we need a comparison. That's the only way we can see the need of your community is to compare it against the state, the county, or city that your targeted community is in. Discuss these demographics indicators and how they relate to the current challenges and environmental justice concerns, such as the disproportionate siting of polluting facilities or proliferation of brownfield sites in your community, including the environmental, social, public health, and economic issues as a result of the presence of brownfields in your community. Demonstrate how you will recruit and train unemployed or underemployed individuals of specific populations indicative of needs, such as ex-offenders, veterans. Again, remember, it all goes back to those communities. Your areas must have these particular issues as a result of the presence of brownfields in your community. And again, note, applicants will be evaluated on the extent to which statistics such as these exceed county, city, state, and or national averages. Next slide shows you the suggested format for the demographic information. And as you can see, we have the indicators listed with the comparison statistics going across the table. Show your resources, where you garnered the information that you're showing us, as you see below in the sample table. Next slide. Again, continuing with community need, discuss your labor market demand. That's worth 10 points. Detail the methods and the result of your recent labor market assessment and employer surveys you have conducted in your community. And I strongly suggest that you do these before you apply for this grant. To what extent do these results indicate a demand for skilled environmental professionals with the certifications you are proposing to incorporate into your curriculum? So see, there's a tie-in. You need the assessment, the LMA, and the employer survey to be able to link back to the certifications that you are proposing to provide to your trainees. Next slide. Training program description, anticipated outcomes and outputs. Now, in the guidelines, they do give you a definition of the outcomes and the outputs. It's very important that you understand that. Outputs are specific to each project. Oh, wait just a minute. I'm sorry. Outputs. The term outputs refers to environmental activity, effort, and or associated work product related to an environmental goal or objective that will be produced or provided over a period of time or by a specified date. Outputs may be quantitative or qualitative, but must be measurable. That's the most important thing, must be measurable during the project period. The expected outputs for grants awards under these guidelines may include, but are not limited to, the number, the train, how many you will train, how many you will recruit, how many will be placed into jobs. The terms outcomes refers to results, effect or consequence that will occur from carrying out the activities under the grant. Outcomes may be environmental, behavior, health-related, or programmatic. And again, they must be quantitative, but may not necessarily be achievable during the project period. For the training program structure, look at the sample table provided below, and you are to include the course name, type of training, awareness, and advanced level training, type of certifications to be earned, number of hours per course, total number of hours for the program, course schedule, and training provider if known. And the next slide shows a sample table or suggested table format where you can list the course and the course names, the curriculum topic, type of training. And very important, because a lot of people lose points on something this simple, indicate what type of certificate will be earned, whether it's programmatic, state, or federally recognized. The number of hours it will take to earn the certificate on this particular course, the start date and completion date, and number of times the course will be offered, and who will be providing the training. Again, the linkage. To what extent will the certifications graduates earn ensure employment and apply to the hiring needs of employers in your community? And to what extent is the proposed curriculum comprehensive, realistic, and detailed? Comprehensive is very important because, as Joe indicated earlier, this is not about short-term employment. This is about long-term sustainable employment. So the more comprehensive your training program is, the more successful a graduate will be in ascertaining a job. And it must be realistic. What can you realistically succeed at in delivering, in training, and detail it? Outputs and outcomes. We provide a sample table for the outputs and outcomes. You detail how many participants you plan to enroll, the number of students anticipated to graduate, and your targeted placement rate for the graduates in environmental employment. And you see the sample table provided. In doing so, when you're discussing your outputs and outcomes, think about how you will evaluate the progress towards achieving the expected short-term and the long-term project outputs and outcomes, including but not limited to those identified in section ID, Roman numeral 1D, I think it is. To what extent is your proposed timeline for achieving deliverables of the project as reflected in the attached milestones? A milestone should indicate a start date, an end date, and what milestone will be reached. The schedule, and it must clearly be identified, detailed, and realistic for your projected achieving of the deliverables. Next slide, for number 46. Recruitment and screening, 4 points, section C. Describe the process you plan to utilize to recruit students and market your environmental workforce development and job training program. Discuss the screening, retention, and attrition strategies and processes that you will utilize within your program. Most people are successful at discussing the screening and retention. They lose points because they neglect to discuss attrition strategies. How will you keep a student in your program? To what extent will fees, if any, licensing, certification, and medical examination fees burden the participants in your program? Note, any such fees you collect will be considered programmatic income under 40 CFR Part 30 and 31. To what extent are the training facilities accessible? The proximity to public transportation, parking, et cetera. Section D, program support, worth 6 points. Describe the job search support and resources for participants of your job training program. To what extent will your organization assist with initial job placement and continuous employment for the participants? To what extent will your organization track graduates and for how long? Remember, the minimum that you're required for tracking is 1 year. To what extent will you utilize federal and local hiring incentives, such as first source or local hiring ordinances, tax incentives, wage subsidies, et cetera? These hopefully will increase the likelihood of employment for program graduates in your community, and how will you market these incentives to employers? And note well, the acceptable placement rate for fiscal year 13 is 70% placement. So if you train 100, we expect for at least 70 of your participants to be placed into long-term sustainable employment. Next slide, number 48. Programmatic capabilities. Again, this will be reviewed and scored by regional reviewers only. What's your grant management system? Describe the management system you have in place to direct activities under the grant. Include a brief description of your project manager and staff and a discussion of the expertise, qualifications, and experience. Discuss the means you have to retain, and this is where people lose points too. So star it and underscore it, because a lot of people skip this. Discuss the means you have to retain project leadership or recruit qualified staff should employee turnover occur. Describe the system you have in place to acquire additional expertise and resources required to perform the proposed project. If you intend to contract for necessary expertise, describe the system, the process you will have in place to acquire that expertise. And again, refer to section Roman numeral 2 of the guidelines. Next slide. Again, with programmatic capability. Describe the management system you have in place to direct activities under the grant. Include a brief description of your project manager and staff and a discussion of the expertise, qualifications, and experience. And remember, or not remember, but note, it says brief description. You will have a page limitation of 15 pages, so say what you need to say, say it well, say it clearly, explicitly, and move on.
Kathleen, I think that Section A is posted twice in this PowerPoint.
Is it really? down, down.
Go to section B.
Okay. Okay, go. I apologize. It's not on this one, but okay. B, organization experience. Discuss your organization's and training providers' experience in working with minorities, unemployed veterans, and ex-offenders in the community you propose to serve. Again, people lose points here because they neglect to discuss that. If you don't have experience, just say so. Don't ignore it. Because all you have to do is you read this, you don't have the experience yourself, but whoever your provider is perhaps will, not perhaps, will have to have it, training provider. But do not skip it. Answer every single one of the sub-factors because that's an easy way to lose points by skipping any of them. Describe any previous experience your organization has had in environmental training as it relates to your proposed curriculum. If you do not have an instructor on staff and are considering subcontracting or subgranting for these services, detail the criteria you will use to select these services. Please note, please provide a commitment letter from the training provider being considered by your organization. So if you have someone in mind, you've discussed it, and of course, in that with you, when you make your statement, please make sure that you follow procurement requirements of Part 3031, which ever applies to your organization. Discuss any experience your organization has in the employment and training field at large. Audit findings. Describe any adverse audit findings. If you have had problems with the administration of any grant, describe how you have corrected or are correcting the problem. Next slide, number 52. Past performance and accomplishments. If you have ever received an EPA job training grant, please respond to item 1 below. If you have not had any experience or have not received, rather not received an EPA job training grant, but have received other federal, non-federal assistance grants, including EPA Brownfields Assessment, RLF, or cleanup grants, respond to item 2 below. If you have never received any type of federal or non-federal assistance agreements, please state so in the proposal, and you will receive a neutral score of 6 points. Failure, note well, failure to do so to respond may result in 0 points for this criteria. And this is a very tight, competitive grant process. So please do not lose points for failure to not respond, or failure to respond, rather. And in evaluating an applicant's response to this criterion, EPA may consider relevant information from EPA files and or from other federal and or non-federal grantors to verify or supplement information provided by the applicant. So it would probably be a good idea if, when applying for this grant, that you notify those that have awarded you grants from other agencies, just send them a letter letting them know that you're doing this, so they'll be prepared if they're contacted. And of course, the first little Roman numeral 1, current or has ever received an EPA Brownfields job training grant, you would respond to identifying the job training grants that you have currently or have received in the past, demonstrate your success in managing the grant and all phases under those grants, and you would do so by providing information on your funds expenditure, any balance that was left but not drawn down at the end of the grant, and if you had a balance, please discuss why, oh no, if you have an open EPA job training grant, please indicate your need for additional funding based on remaining funds. Compliance of grant requirements, information regarding your compliance with the work plan, schedule, terms, and conditions, and are you making sufficient progress on your current grant? information regarding your timely quarterly and annual reporting, as well as ongoing ACRES reporting. Discuss your accomplishments, the number of individuals you committed in your proposal to train, did you train them and place them, and the number that were actually trained and the actual versus the number that was actually placed. Again, with the accomplishments, next slide, number 55, were the original anticipated training and placement goals were met? And if not, what steps have you taken to improve the program so that your goals will be met under the new grant if awarded? Whether the data is accurately reflected in the ACRES at the time of this proposal submission, and if not, why not? Roman numeral 2, has not received an EPA job training grant but has received other federal or non-federal assistance agreements, including EPA assessment. Respond to subfactor requesting you to identify current and or prior federally or non-federally funded assistance agreements, including the EPA Brownfields grants that you currently have or have received in the past. If you work with the EPA on delivering a Superfund job training initiative, JTI project, please discuss this in this section. Provide information on no more than 5 years of your most recent assistance agreements. Describe the history of successfully managing these agreements and performing the agreements, including information regarding your compliance with the work plan, including schedule, progress, and terms and conditions. And B, information regarding your meeting and complying with reporting requirements, including quarterly reporting, technical reports, final reports, data entry into ACRES, is applicable. And also remember that you state, and then we go to the project officer that manages your grant for confirmation. So it's very important if you have any outstanding quarterly reports due, if you haven't gone into ACRES or haven't submitted your job training report form, this is the time to do it prior to you submitting your grant application. And note well, in evaluating responses, the EPA may consider relevant information from EPA files or from other federal grantors to verify or supplement information provided by the applicant. Next slide, number 58. Community employer partnerships worth 25 points overall. And if you notice, I've delineated what's being asked of you. In the guidelines, this is all in one big paragraph. It's very important that you go through your guidelines and you break those paragraphs down to find out what is being asked of you so you don't miss a subfactor within the categories. The first thing that we're looking for is to see whether or not you're collaborating with your solid and hazardous waste site communities. You're to describe any specific efforts that you've made to collaborate with Brownfield Assessment, Revolving Loan Fund, and Cleanup Grantees, and or Superfund, federal facility leaking underground storage tanks, EPA-funded state or tribal-regulated corrective action or landfill closure contractors, that's a mouthful, or wastewater treatment facilities in your community. That's a lot being asked of you. So check it off as you respond. There's four categories there in that one. Whether or not you've collaborated with any of the Brownfield grantees, Superfund, or federal facility, LUST, leaking underground storage tank, or EPA-funded state or tribal-regulated corrective action or landfill closure contractors. It's five, or wastewater treatment facilities in your community. All of those will go towards earning that 4 points, so respond to them. provide detailed information how these efforts will enhance and foster future employment for job training graduates in the community. In other words, how are you building your network so that you will be able to network your graduates into jobs within the community? Describe your organization's relationship with your local economic development office and how this relationship will result in placement of graduates with local contractors in your community. If applicable, provide letters of support for any commitments these organizations make to assist with your training program, such as to provide on-the-job training or to hire graduates. Next slide. Community partnership building, worth 8 points. Describe your plan for involving the affected community. Again, the local community groups, the WIBIs, and academic institutions located in or near the affected community in the proposed job training program. Make sure you have letters of support for any of these organizations that you are saying are partnering with you in this effort. To what extent did you notify, involve, or hold any public comment sessions in the target community before applying or during the development of your proposal? Next slide. Also, note down here, make sure if you receive a letter of support that is on the partner's letterhead with a current date and includes acknowledgement of the proposed project, support for the project, organization's roles and commitment for the project term, and any supplemental funding or in-kind commitments. Statement is made stronger by assigning a dollar value to committed in-kind services for leveraging purposes. Slide 60, community partnership building continues. To what extent have partners committed to providing non-environmental training, such as GED attainment, life skills training, transportation, access, child care, personal protective equipment, PPE, etc.? Again, attach the letters of support indicating commitments these organizations will make or have made. Describe your program and partners' expertise to ensure trainees are job ready and have the pre-employment skills needed to secure full-time work. Note, carefully review in Section 2D and 2E before identifying a partner who you intend to provide EPA funds to under a procurement contract or sub-grant. Next slide, 61, employment involvement. To what extent has the employer community, local businesses, environmental contractors, labor unions, site owners, et cetera, been involved in the development of proposed job training programs? For instance, your curriculum development, have they agreed to sit on the advisory council, provide apprenticeships and mentoring opportunities? Provide detailed information on specific efforts related to employer involvement, such as meeting dates that occurred during the preparation of this proposal. Discuss to what extent employers committed to hiring graduates of your proposed program. Discuss any partnerships you have established with employers who have hired graduates of your program in the past. Again, provide the LOS from past and prospective employers that affirm their involvement and commitment to the proposed program. The LOS are very important for maximum points on this particular criterion. Without the letters of support, statements are considered not to be substantiated and very little value, if any, is given. Make sure each letter of support is on partner's letterhead with a current date and includes acknowledgement of the proposed project, support for the project, organization's roles and commitment for the project, term and any supplemental funding or in-kind commitments. Again, the statement is made stronger by assigning a dollar value to the committed in-kind services. Next slide. Budget resource is worth 8 points. For section sub-factor A, the budget itself, make sure you use the table format below to identify specific tasks for which EPA funding will be used. Show the cost by budget category associated with each task. Note the task is provided in the table below for examples, not necessarily required. In addition to the budget table, describe in narrative format each task in detail. Include the basis for the estimated cost as well as the projected outputs where possible. For an example, student safety equipment for 100 students at a cost of $50 each for a total of $5,000. Again, pay attention to the highlighted starred notes. We encourage each of you to set aside appropriate funding to support placement and required tracking upon completion of the last training class. Remember, minimum tracking is for 1 year after graduation. As you can see on the next page, on the next slide, slide 63, we give you a suggested table. And again, if you go down, you see non-EPA project funding. This is optional for you to put it here. But if you do have non-EPA project funding, it is very important that you separate it apart from the total EPA funds that you're budgeting for. And again, a start note, make sure you do not include tasks or activities or costs that are ineligible uses for the funds. This includes administrative costs, as described in Appendix 1. And for additional examples of ineligible uses for costs under the grant funds, refer to the FAQs, and the website is given for it. Next slide, 64, the budget narrative. In the narrative, include a short introduction before the budget chart outlining how you intend to spend the grant funds. Then you present the budget chart. Subsequent to the budget chart, include a budget narrative explaining each of your tasks and make it clear and complete. Include in your narrative the basis for the estimated cost, projected outputs where possible, address each cost presented under the task. The task should correlate with the proposed project's work plan. The cost should appear reasonable based on the details in the description and list the responsible party assigned to complete the task or activity. Note well that this is where many of the applicants lose points. Applicants must provide both the chart, the budget chart, and the narrative in order to be provided full points for this particular category. Reminder, on slide 65, do not include tasks for activities or costs that are ineligible use of funds under EPA grants when you're discussing EPA funds to be expended, such as indirect costs are ineligible. A list of prohibited uses of funds can be found in Appendix 1 of the Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Guidelines. That should say FY 2013. Don't use acronyms like CBO, spell them out. Allocate travel funds to attend the Brownfields Conference and the annual job training all grantee meeting under travel. And make sure your budget table adds up going across and down each column to equal the $200,000. Next slide. Leveraging. To what extent are in-kind or partner commitments providing services or resources to the proposed job training program? For example, discuss staff time, life skills training, pre-employment training, student stipends, supplies, transportation, bus tokens, any leveraging of resources or additional funds that is not EPA awarded should be discussed in this particular sub-factor. The question is, are these commitments current and confirmed? How do you show that? Through your letters of support. Again, it's very, very important that you provide letters of support for any leveraging. And make sure, again, that is on the letterhead of the partner and the current date and includes acknowledgement of the proposed project, the role or commitment that your partner is stating, and spell it out. What type of in-kind service with a dollar amount, assign if possible, or supplementary funding that they're committing to. Next question is, if this isn't current and confirmed, what is the likelihood that these commitments will materialize during the project? In other words, what guarantees do you have that the commitments will be honored? Describe how your organization will manage this grant in light of the administrative cost prohibition. Again, cost shares are not required for this grant. Again, discussing leveraging. When reviewing your budget, ensure that you demonstrated how you will leverage additional funds or in-kind service to carry out your project. Make sure you describe the additional sources of internal or external funding that is currently in place. And in doing so, ensure that you show how EPA grant funds will be complemented by these additional funding sources or in-kind services. And this is the duplication, so we've discussed it. So slide 68, going to the other factors. Okay, in making the final selection, EPA selection official may consider other factors as appropriate as listed below. Whether the applicant seeks to serve a community severely impacted by a manufacturing plant closure occurring 2007 or later, including an auto plant closure or other significant economic disruption. A fair distribution of funds between urban and non-urban areas, including funding to micro communities, those communities with a population of 10,000 or less, or rural communities where communities with populations of 20,000 or less and not located within a metropolitan statistical area. Fair geographic distribution of funds among EPA's 10 regions, and fair distributions of funds between new applicants and previous job training grant recipients. Again, what will be considered in the decision is whether the applicant is a federally recognized Indian tribe or United States territory, or is an organization that will serve tribal or territorial residents. Whether the applicant seeks to serve a community severely impacted by a natural disaster, again occurring 2005 or later. Whether proposals seek to deliver training beyond brownfields hazardous waste, such as wastewater, water quality, USTs, removal, Superfund, solid waste, emergency response, enhanced chemical safety training. Whether the applicant is a recipient of a HUD, Department of Transportation, or EPA Partnership Sustainable Communities, PSC, grant, and a proposed target area includes the same area served through the PSC funding. And that shouldn't be or there. That is three agencies that have formed a partnership. So it's HUD, DOT, and EPA rather than or EPA. Proposals that seek to serve areas designated as empowerment zone or renewal community. Environmental justice, a community that bears a disproportionate impact of environmental contamination or faces adversely high cumulative environmental impact. And lastly, proposals that seek to serve veterans. Please note the STARD statement below. Applicants must complete and submit the other factors checklist, Appendix 3, as part of their attachment. Failure to do so may affect EPA's ability to consider these factors during selection decisions. The EPA may verify this information prior to selection and consider this information during the evaluation process. Before you submit your proposal, we have provided a checklist under Section VD, Section 5D. Please ensure that the following documents are included in your package submitted to EPA and EPA's contractor. First, the transmittal letter. 3-page limit, the narrative proposal, which includes responses to all 5 ranking criteria, and that's a 15-page limit, the attachments that must be included, and all attachments, 15-page limit. But what must, again, be included, the reference list, the milestones description and charts, milestones, general letters of support from partners identifying your proposal. And I would suggest that you provide each of your partners listed in your proposal a copy of your proposal at the time you submit it. So when they're called upon, they will be able to say yes, know of it, support it, aware of it. The other factors checklist and documentation, if applicable, of applicants' eligibility other than city, county, or state, or tribe. And note that this documentation for applicant eligibility, and here what we're talking about are nonprofits. This does not count against your page limitations. Documentation of applicant eligibility is A, and they give you, this is the tables of contents basically on slide 72. And your documentation of applicant eligibility, A, applicants that are not cities, counties, tribes, or states must provide documentation, evidence of current nonprofit status under federal, state, or tribal law. Evidence of the nonprofit status must be submitted at the time of application. The status must be current and in compliance with the IRS requirements for nonprofit organizations. Documentation, again, of nonprofit status will not count against your attachment page limitations. Your references. These organizations may be contacted by EPA during the evaluation process. And this is a list with contact information, not letters, of 2 employees who have hired past participants of your job training program, if applicable, 2 neighborhood and or community-based organizations aiding in the development of your program, and 2 organizations from the employer community, local businesses, environmental contractors, site owners, et cetera, that have been involved in the development of your job training program. Make sure that any partner agency, company, organization, or government office listed as partners or employers receive a copy of your proposal with a cover letter explaining that you are submitting the proposal and they're listed within as a partner. There's nothing worse than a listed partner employer being contacted and they don't know anything about your proposal or proposed training project. Next slide. Your milestone schedule should include start and completion dates for significant tasks. And the significant tasks as listed are outreach, procurement of a contractor, recruiting and screening, training cycle, start and completion date, class schedule, start and end time with number of total hours indicated. And with that class schedule, should also, that's where you should list your certificates that will be earned and what type of certificates, whether they're federal, state, programmatic, or industry, placement and tracking for each cycle. Attach your general letters of support from community-based organizations, past or potential employers, organizations involved in the development of your job training program, project partners, or other stakeholders that support your proposed training under attachments. Support letters will only impact scoring of the sub-factors listed in Section B, Section 5B4, Community and Employer Partnerships of the Guidelines. Letters, note well, there are no late submittals. Letters must be received with the proposal. Your proof of nonprofit eligibility must be submitted with the proposal. Any letter, any document received separately after the due date for the proposed submission will not be considered. That date is April 9th, 2013. Joe, you want to take it from here?
Sure. So we're on page 77. These are some general tips for proposal preparation. Obviously, read the entire guidelines. Get mentoring from prior grantees. There's contact information at the website listed there. Write as though the reader knows nothing about your community. Follow the instructions in Section 4 of the Guidelines for Application Submission. Address all criteria, even if it doesn't apply. Say so and explain why. Avoid using acronyms and technical jargon. Follow cover letter outline, see Section 4. Use white space and obey the 15-page limit for the narrative proposal, the 3-page limit for the transmittal or cover letter, and the 15-page limit for attachment. Pages in excess of page limits will be removed and will not be reviewed or evaluated. It's really sad when we get a proposal and the contractor's removed the last 3 pages of the proposal. The applicant loses a lot of points. Limit attachments to required and relevant documents and currently dated letters. No photos or graphics, and electronic submission through grants.gov of applications is allowed. Next slide.
So can I add here, when you're calling on prior grantees, make sure you check the year that they were granted, because if they were in 2011, they're probably reapplying and will not be that cooperative with mentor you, because you'll be in direct competition.
Create a focus plan and show that you know how to implement it. Read the guidelines for comprehension. In order to respond in detail and on point to the criteria, you must first be familiar with and understand the program. Too much information is not necessarily a good thing. Quality beats quantity. Do not restate the evaluation criteria. Do not recycle the proposal you submitted last year. The guidance, the guidelines, and format requirements have changed and generally do each year. Respond clearly and directly to the questions and the guidelines. Although your responses may seem repetitious, respond as many times as asked. Some reviewers may not always cross-reference responses. Next slide. Address all criteria. Create a game plan for each section in the application. Highlight keywords that you will want to use in your response. Identify information that you will need to research or obtain to answer the questions. For pertinent sections, design the actual plan you will implement if you receive a grant. Be realistic in your planning. Use your plan to answer the questions. A strong understanding of your proposed program concepts and well-thought-out plans will come through in your application. Two things I also wanted to mention. Oftentimes, we'll read a proposal that says, we will partner with this community-based organization, or we will hold a public meeting if we receive a grant. If we get a proposal that says we already have the following partnerships in place, we have an advisory committee, we held a public meeting, and this was the feedback that we received from local residents about the proposed training program, that proposal is going to be scored more favorably than, well, if we get the funding, we'll do this. We want to fund communities that are ready to go. Another thing, you know, again, for new applicants or for those of you who are new to this RFP, don't be intimidated. Oftentimes we have applicants such as community colleges. Maybe they're experienced in environmental training or they have an industrial hygiene department, but they don't know anything about employment and training or the social services arm. On the other hand, we'll have nonprofit organizations with the social services experience, but they don't know what a brownfield site is. So we really look for that partnership. As I mentioned, life skills training is not an eligible use of funds. So oftentimes we'll look for partnerships with community-based organizations or workforce investment boards that can offer those critical services. If you're a local governmental entity and you plan on subbing out to get a training provider or other services, make sure that you follow the proper procurement strategies that Kathleen spoke about. On page 80, here are some of the important dates. So yesterday, the request for proposals was issued. The deadline, again, is April 9th, and we plan to announce the grant in June. That's anticipated. The FY13 applications will be accepted through grants.gov, as mentioned. Threshold criteria and programmatic capability are evaluated by the EPA region where the proposal is targeting whichever community. Programmatic capability, again, scored by the region. National panels will convene and rank applications. Federal partners will also sit on the evaluation panels. The Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response Assistant Administrator is the selection official and makes the final selection determination, taking into consideration those other factors which Kathleen discussed. Our statute really says that the highest scored proposals receive funding, but we do take into account those other factors. What to do now? Access and read for comprehension and clarity of the guidelines. The FAQs for FY13, we have not posted those yet. I hope that those will be posted next week. Begin compiling and organizing the required documentation to insert into your application package. Conduct your employer survey and get commitments from employers to participate in your program and to hire. You don't necessarily have to do a labor market assessment, but maybe another organization in your community did a labor market assessment that you could use. The same with employer surveying. Don't be intimidated. Ideally, we would like to see employers that are making commitments to hire individuals of the program, but we know it's tough times. So maybe they'll at least express a willingness to interview graduates of the program. Request and collect individualized letters of support. Don't use boilerplate letters of support. Hold a public meeting. Plan to offer opportunity for public comment and input and not to just inform the public about your plans to submit a proposal. Contact partners for assistance in preparing or reviewing your proposal for clarity and completeness. And you can contact us with any eligibility questions. Since the competition is open now, the EPA will not review your proposal or provide you any tips on the side about responding to the ranking criteria. It is a competition, and we take this seriously. On the next slide, page 83, here is a list of all the regional EPA job training coordinators. Many of these people have been working on this program since 1998. Next slide. Here are some web-based resources. There's the link to the guidelines, the FAQs, and if you haven't done so already, please take a look at the Environmental Workforce Development and Job Training Grant webpage. There are a lot of resources there. We have reports on there. We also have a link to the Hazardous Materials Training Research Institute. And I mention them because the EPA has a grant with HMTRI to provide technical assistance to both prospective applicants and existing job training grantees. There's a list of past recipients in your target area. The next slide, here's a picture of one of our grantees, the graduation, probably everything that you guys work up to. This is the event that makes it all worth it. This is Florida State College at Jacksonville in 2011. With that, I'm going to shut up now and open it up to questions, and Jean is going to send those questions over.
Great. Thank you. Thanks so much, Joe and Kathleen. So we do have a number of questions that have already been submitted electronically in the queue. And just a reminder for those of you that are on the line, if you haven't typed up your comment or question, I'd encourage you to go ahead and do so now. In the lower right corner of your screen, you should see a Q&A window. If you expanded the slides or made them bigger, you're going to want to press the full screen button to shrink them back down to the normal size, and you can see the Q&A in the lower right corner. You can type your comment or question electronically at the very bottom in the thin white field that shows up and press the little cartoon bubble to the right, and that'll electronically submit the questions. I'm going to start reading through some of these questions, and our first question comes in from a user who would like to know if the $200,000 limit is per year or over 3 years.
That is over 3 years. And as I mentioned, we expanded the grant project period from 2 to 3 years. We would ideally like to see training wrapped up by the end of year two. And we really built that third year in so grantees could really focus on remaining placement of graduates and tracking and reporting. We knew that many times in the past when the grant closed out, there were placements that occurred, and we, the EPA, we didn't receive that information. So that last final year, we would really like to see applicants focus on placement, tracking, reporting.
Okay, great. Thank you. Our next participant would like you to explain the difference between retention and attrition.
Kathleen, you're the retention and attrition.
The difference between, you said attrition and retention?
That's correct.
Okay. It's truly semantics, I believe, but it's in how you approach it. I believe retention is being proactive, where you have it, you have systems and processes built in your training program to be proactive to the issues that you know that your particular audience will incur, such as child care issues, no funds in order to ride public transportation to get to training. Whereas attrition is someone comes here and says, I quit the program. And in order to retain them, you start responding, finding out what their problems are and seeing if you can assist. One is you're being proactive with retention. Attrition, you're being reactive.
Okay, great.
Is that,
I
think that we also want to ensure that trainees are retained in the training program. And attrition,
right.
You know, we also want to focus on sustainable employment.
Yeah.
We don't want someone to go to work for one day and then they're unemployed again. We want grantees to continue to provide placement assistance.
And that's long-term sustainable employment. That's the purpose and goal of the program.
Okay. Our next user is asking if their fees for certification are considered an eligible cost.
Yeah. But, you know, again, hopefully those fees aren't going to cost too much. But yes, you can use the grant funds to pay for licensing, et cetera.
As long as it occurs prior to graduation. Once a trainee has graduated from the program, then you may not utilize grant funds to pay for the licensing fees.
Okay. We have another participant who states that for B, organizational experience, if they're planning to use a contractor for certain tasks, should they ask for a commitment letter from the providers that you attend to contract with? We put out competitive RFPs for contracted services and would not know who the provider will be prior to sending in the proposal. So how should they address that?
Then they don't need a letter of support from them. This is someone where you've talked, when we say intending to contract with, that's a training provider you've spoken with. They've agreed to, prior to you submitting the proposal, that they will be your training provider, with the caveat that in making the selection prior to the agreement, you have followed the procurement requirements of CFR 40, CFR 30, and 31.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have another participant who has a question about past performance on grants. They'd like to know, how does a state regulatory agency respond to this when they've received many grants from EPA but still answer the question briefly?
Well, I think you would onto the second one.
Discuss the past 5 years of grant experience.
Right. You haven't received an EPA job training grant, so you would respond to smaller Roman numeral two.
Right.
Okay, great.
We love states to apply.
Excellent, thank you. We have another user who would like to know if you could elaborate on the non-EPA funds as shown in the budget table.
Those are elaborate resources, in-kind resources.
And can you give examples of those?
We're flexible. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Someone providing life skills training. That's a non-EPA funded but needed activity. So you get a partner such as a WIBI that will provide the life skills training. That's basically job readiness. And so rather than just saying we will provide it, you put in the WIBI board will agree to provide it for all 6 cycles at an estimated cost of. So, and that way it shows that it's leveraged funds and it's in-kind services. And then, of course, make sure the letter of support mirrors what you're stating. Another in-kind are bus tokens from another nonprofit organization who says that they'll provide the bus tokens for your graduates. Again, that's they're providing the tokens, but that has a monetary value, so you would put that down there as leveraged funds.
Okay, great. Another user is commenting on one of the requirements, and this is their statement. They basically say that it's fairly difficult to attain one of the components you listed. Specifically, in their past experience, most employers do not want to commit to employment and hiring the graduates of the program. So for the purposes of the grant, do they need a firm commitment or an agreement from them to participate if they're able to do that?
Well, it's as Joe said, we don't expect for any employer in this day and age to say we will hire 10 students from your – we agree to give consideration, i.e. an interview, first consideration of an interview for future hiring, future open positions with our organization. We anticipate in the next 3 years 5 openings.
Right.
Joe, isn't that correct?
Right. I agree. And I would state that there are applicants that are going to come in. I don't want others to be intimidated, but they have established rapport with employers. And those
right.
employers will specifically say, we plan to hire X number of individuals. We've worked with this applicant for 10 years. They have excellent trained staff, and we're ready to hire.
And that's very true. But they'll also put in a caveat based on our projected hiring needs. Future hiring needs.
Okay. Our next user has commented that they have been unsuccessful in their efforts to secure a Brownfields grant in the past. They did, however, obtain a targeted Brownfields assessment for one major project. Would that need to be noted in their narrative referring to a prior Brownfields support?
No, because that was not funds directly awarded to them. That was services awarded to them.
Okay, great. Our next user would like to know if you can give them an idea of how many students were trained by last year's awardees and about how many contact hours these projects averaged.
I'll respond to that one. So that's a really good question, and we have a FAQ on that. A lot of applicants say, you know, what's the general number of individuals to be trained through a program? And that varies depending on the comprehensiveness of your proposed curriculum. Whether or not you're in a rural or urban area, maybe you are going to have a really easy time recruiting. I would say that usually it's about 15 to 20 individuals per cycle with 2 cycles per grant award. We would definitely like to see as many individuals trained as possible. Be realistic, but don't be overly ambitious. We want ambition, but be realistic.
Realistic ambition.
Right. Excellent. We have another user who, again, related to the number of trainees. What is the minimum number of trainees per year?
We don't have a set bar minimum. I would just give, you know, a shot in the dark and say the minimum, absolute minimum, would probably allow an applicant to train, I don't know, 25? I think that's pretty low. And I think maybe you're going to be located in, you know, rural Alaska.
Well, for instance, on a tribe. The tribe is its own environmental agency. You know, they may train 5 per cycle with 2 cycles ending each year ending up with 20. But they're going to hire all within. And it may even be 5 per year being 10. But all 100% will be hired. It depends on the applicant and the location and the region. If you're a big urban area, you'll be laughed out of the room if you come in saying we will train 10 per cycle or 10 per year to be 20. I generally look for 20 to 25 per cycle, meaning that that's per year. Or rather, 15 and 15, 30 with 60 for the 2 years, so 30 per year. And with 2 cycles being 15, that's my norm. I have some that have just taken it out the ballpark and have placed them in the high 80s and 90s. It just depends on how comprehensive and how well you know your employer community and how successful you will be. Just to go out there and guess an arbitrary number, I can guarantee you will not be successful. You have to get to know your employer community before you can project any type of training numbers and placement numbers.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have another user who would like to know why the Alaskan tribes are ineligible to participate in this grant opportunity. Is there another source for funding needed for training for future employment in the environmental fields that are addressed in herein? Because they specifically represent an Alaska tribe, but really enjoyed the presentation and learned a lot. So they want to know what they should do since they're ineligible, and if you can explain why they're ineligible.
So the Brownfields Law, I would say you need to ask your congressman. We find it unfortunate that Alaskan tribes, except the Metlakatla tribe, are ineligible. The only tribe in Alaska that's eligible is Metlakatla. We do have a grant currently, though, with a nonprofit organization in Alaska that is specifically targeting tribes and Native villages throughout Alaska. I suggest that perhaps you're a tribe, but you have a nonprofit arm, so the nonprofit could apply. But, you know, that's a statutory requirement that we have to follow. It's unfortunate, and maybe one day it'll change if the law gets reauthorized.
And I would strongly suggest that you contact Region 10 and speak with Susan Morales to discuss further on how you may be able to circumvent it. As Joe said, partnering with a nonprofit or having a nonprofit within your own.
Or getting the state or a university to apply.
Right. Community college would be better, probably.
Okay. We have our next participant who would like to know what percentage of placement should be underemployed and what percentage what percent of placement should be unemployed and what percent should be listed for underemployed?
Again, we don't set a line for that. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Another user mentions that they have letters of support that are dated November 2012. Are those letters considered, quote, current, or are they outdated?
I think that would be okay, and I understand we were hoping to have this RFP issued to the public earlier, but I think the more recent, the better. But I think that would be okay.
I agree with Joe, because we had projected that it would be out in December. Now, that's called being ambitious unrealistically, I guess, huh? but I think within the 6 months, wouldn't you say, Joe, within 6 months?
Yeah.
Of the proposal, we would consider current.
Yeah.
Okay. Our next user would ask you to clarify your position on having public meeting feedback, notifying the community members about their proposal. And again, they're just asking you to clarify more information. So I don't know if you can talk more about the need to have a public meeting and getting feedback, as well as notifying the community members about your proposal.
Well, we would like to see applicants that have involved the community in the development of the proposal, including employers, community-based organizations, local residents. Like I said, oftentimes we'll see proposals that come in and say, if we get a grant award, we'll hold a public meeting to solicit feedback. Hopefully you already did that when you were developing your proposal.
Okay. We have another user who would like to know if graduates need to be placed into a job in their community, or can they be placed in a job in another community after completing the program?
Ideally, this program was created to benefit residents, predominantly low-income, minority, and other unemployed residents in the community. We especially understand that, you know, for rural communities, maybe a graduate's going to have to travel, you know, an hour to a neighboring town to work at a Superfund site, for example. I think that's okay, but we would ideally like to see that graduates are being placed in the community that's applying.
Okay. Can you comment if applicants can apply every 2 years, or do they have to wait and apply every 3 years?
They have to wait every other year unless they are proposing to serve a different city. So if you got a grant last year in FY12, you are not eligible to come in this year unless you are proposing to serve a different city. We know some organizations are national in scope. They do excellent work, but, you know, the selection official is also going to look at those that have received grants in the past and those that have not.
Okay.
We like to see the funds equitably distributed.
Okay. There's a clarifying statement here about the in-kind resources. And they just kind of list two things. They ask if in-kind resources from any partner identified or the grant project manager's in-kind services. I don't know if you guys can elaborate on either of those two items.
It could be in-kind services from the actual applicant, but it could be also in-kind services from partners. Maybe it's not going to be hard cash that a partner is going to provide to support the proposed project.
For example, a past grantee, being a college, didn't have to pay for training. So their training instructors was leveraged in kind
19
services. They didn't have to pay a training provider. So whatever the cost, when they applied a value to those training instructors, hours became leveraged in kind. Or in-kind leveraging, I guess I should say.
Okay.
A dollar amount. Okay. And that was the grantee itself.
All right. We have one user who would like to know if it's better to submit two proposals if they're considering two target areas, or is it better for one proposal to be submitted that's serving two communities or physical locations?
I think it would be okay. I mean, if they're neighboring communities, or maybe you're in South Carolina and there's, you know, three counties that you want to serve. However, if you're proposing to serve Chicago and New Orleans, then you should probably submit two different proposals. The community, you're going to have to address the community needs section, and you know the demographics are going to be a lot different, et cetera.
Okay. And we have another question in the queue, and this is sort of a general question. One of the participants asked if you can actually highlight the general differences between this year's RFP and last year's RFP.
Sure. One of the main changes, and I think one of the comments I got last year about the CLUIN is that we should hold two separate CLUINs, one for past grant recipients and one for newbies. But that's not going to happen. The changes are primarily the change in required training. As mentioned, we do not have several different required trainings. Instead, applicants just need to tell us about those different types of training listed in items 1 through 6. The project period is now 3 years. I think actually last year that was the case too. We do have the other factors checklist now that you need to include. As Gail mentioned, this year there's going to be a strong focus on communities with recent manufacturing plant closures or other significant economic disruptions, including auto plant closures, as well as applicants that are going to touch upon one of the many different types of training listed in items 1 through 6. Renewable energy training is, again, an eligible use of funds, including training in solar installation, weatherization, HVAC, energy auditing, et cetera. I think those are the main changes.
Okay. We have a user who would like to know if building operator training, and then in parentheses, building energy conservation, is an eligible grant expense.
I want to say yes.
Could you repeat it for me, please?
Sure. So the exact question says, would the building operator training, and then in parentheses, building energy conservation, be an eligible grant expense?
Be eligible grant expenditure for training? I would say yes, too. Being a part
about we specifically say BPI, Building Performance Institute-related training is an eligible use of grant funds, or training in energy efficiency, or
right.
Green design, such as LEED, is an eligible use of grant funds. I would hope that you're going to deliver other types of training as well, because I would question how many graduates of your program are going to be working in that specific sector.
Okay. So we don't have any more questions in the online queue, and we have come really close to our scheduled end time. I think I'm just going to try and see if any of our phone line participants have a question before we close things out. So if you're on the telephones and you have a question and have been unable to type them up electronically, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute. You would hit #6 on your telephone and then identify yourself or your organization and feel free to ask your question. Okay, I don't hear anybody on
the...
Don't
be shy.
And for those of you, I do have a couple people who have asked how to get copies of the PowerPoint presentation. I'll be covering that before we close things out today, so don't worry. Hang tight.
Are there any other questions? Don't be shy.
Okay, I don't hear anybody else on the phone lines, and again, the only other questions I have in the queue are about getting copies of the PowerPoint presentation. So, Joe, feel free to make any, Joe and Kathleen, any closing statements or comments that you'd like.
Well, we'll be doing this again tomorrow, same time, same station.
No, next Thursday, Kathleen.
Thursday, I thought it was March 1st. Isn't tomorrow March 1st?
No, our next CLUIN is next Thursday from 3 to 5.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you told me that. Because I would be on the phone for hours waiting.
Yeah.
So next Thursday, which is what, March 7th?
7th, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, March 7th.
I guess I would just say thanks for participating on the call today. As I already mentioned more than once, don't be intimidated. If you're brand new to this, we always like to see new faces. I think historically, about 50% of grant funds go to prior grant recipients, and 50% of grant funds go to new applicants.
Hello?
Yeah?
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
You can hear me?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Vanessa Frazier, and I was trying to unmute my phone, but I guess my keys were stuck. I had a quick question. We are in a rural area, and I was listening to the, you want the community to benefit from the trainees as far as employing. And in the rural area that we're in, we basically serve six counties that have rural communities. And would there be a problem if we recruited people from those communities that provided transportation?
I
or would
think
they all
fine.
Have to come from one community?
No,
for the grant?
I think the review panel is going to look at your proposal and take into consideration that you're a rural applicant and that your recruitment area is going to be more expansive. So if it were to be six counties, I think that would be just fine. But, yes, transportation is going to be an issue you're going to have to discuss in your proposal.
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. And we also have one more question that just got snuck in online, but it's a good question, and I'm going to ask it because I think it's very relevant. One of our participants would like to know if the federal government sequestration issues are going to impact the grant awards.
I would say yes, and I think that in the RFP we have $2.4 million listed as the total anticipated amount of funding, but I would assume that we probably won't be able to make, we'll probably have to deduct one or two grants. So that means we'll probably end up funding 10 or 11 grants instead of 12. Unfortunately.
Okay.
I hope that there's not going to be a delay in the announcement date. We're all going to work very hard here to get these proposals reviewed and to make the grant awards as quickly as possible.
Okay, wonderful. So again, Joe, feel free to any, you kind of already highlighted the next delivery. You're going to cover the same content next week. So if you missed out on this, you know people who are going to benefit, they can sign up for next week's delivery of the exact same session. Any other closing statements or thoughts you might like to have and share with the group?
No, I think that's it. Thank you, everybody.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and officially close out today's session and give you a couple of key pieces of information, so don't hang up just yet. If you liked what you saw, this type of information is presented on the Cleanup Information Network website all the time. We have a variety of newsletters, listservs, databases, websites, RSS feeds, online training. So we'd encourage you to visit the CLUIN website. It's CLUIN.org. And you can actually connect with us if you're involved in popular social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. You can connect and stay along and follow with us as we move forward in sharing information with everyone. If you were looking to download a copy of the presentation materials, they're available from the seminar homepage. You'll also find it on the seminar resources or links page. So I pasted that in the Q&A window, so you should all have that active hyperlink there. Again, if you just refer back to the registration emails you received when you signed up, you can go back to the seminar homepage and actually download a PowerPoint or PDF copy of the slides. We would ask if you could also take just a moment and fill out the short feedback form. I've got that hyperlink available in the related URL pod. It's also available from the seminar homepage. It takes just a minute to fill that thing out. I do read each of the responses, and as Joe noted, our presenters will also review that information. It does help us to continue to deliver sessions like this online in the future. If you joined with multiple participants at one spot, each one of you can actually fill out your own feedback form. A number of people have often contacted us looking for certificates or credit for participating for CEUs or PDHs. We don't necessarily offer those types of certificates through Cluin, but if you save a copy of your registration email, save a copy of the presentation materials, and fill out the feedback form, you can check a box and actually have a confirmation message sent to you by email that at least verifies you submitted feedback after the live delivery. And oftentimes our participants can get credit from their accrediting institution using those pieces of information kind of gathered together in a package. So again, we don't give you certificates, but you can ask for a confirmation email sent to you after you fill out the feedback form. And as I mentioned earlier, today's session was recorded. It will be automatically archived, and you'll get an email from me as soon as that's available. We hope to have that up in just a few days. Thank you all so very much for joining us for today's Cluin seminar. I hope that this was a valuable expenditure of your time, and that we'll either see you or hear from you on a future internet session with us. Thank you, and have a great week.